variety of products. Most importantly, gas condensates, liquid gas that is propane and butane, rubber and plastics, synthetic fibers, fertilizers, pesticides and polymers.
In our country, since our gas resources are abundant, most of our petrochemical industries have been developed with gas feed. People may not know this, but, for example, these plastic appliances that they see around them, these furniture and chairs, and even our clothes are made of gas. Therefore, the path that creates added value for the country is that we try to really reduce the acceleration of fuel consumption so that there is enough gas and oil for the petrochemical industry.
In 1998, the Pars Oil and Gas Company was created. To lead the development of South Pars and Pars Special Economic Energy Zone was designated as the 14,000 hectares area in and around the Asaluya district of Bushehr province, where the gas from South Pars enters through pipelines and is processed. The petrochemical complexes are led by the state-owned National Petrochemical Company, but private companies are involved as well, including Tamin Petroleum and Petrochemical Investment Company, Persian Gulf Petrochemical Industries Company, Persian Oil and Gas, Jam Petrochemical, Khark Petrochemical, and Ghadir Investment Company. Although Iran has been developing its petrochemical sector for years, traders and analysts say those efforts accelerated after the U.S. unilaterally withdrew from the nuclear deal in 2018.
In relation to the discussion of oil and gas consumption strategy, we can define four approaches. One approach that has usually prevailed in the past 114 years is the approach of selling crude oil, such as exporting crude oil. The second approach is the issue of selling semi-crude oil and gas. This type of consumption is also very wrong. For example, we convert gas into methanol and export it. This does not bring any value to the country's economy, but in fact, it has negative effects. Or, for example, the export of fuel oil, which is worth less than selling crude oil. Or even the export of gasoline and diesel, which are the same. The third approach is the issue of crude burning. We are really caught in a tsunami of crude burning. We burn 1,000 million liters of gasoline every day. This tsunami of crude burning must be prevented. The fourth approach is to sell through petrochemicals, which is actually our salvation. Our salvation is not exports, not refineries, but petrochemicals. However, the same petrochemical products should not be exported, but should be processed and entered into the chain of the ministry industries and converted into goods and then exported.
Since then, sanctions experts say the Iranian petrochemical industry has expanded its capacity, especially with a focus on generating export revenues. Reports indicate that petrochemical sales have been reinforcing Iran's flagging economy with a combination of sanctions evasion and sanctions resilience, while helping it move up the manufacturing value chain.
It's true that the petrochemical industry has helped us a lot and has gained a lot of currency for us in the current economy of the country, which is not in a good condition. But unfortunately, we could not make proper use of this industry and make sufficient use of the country's potential in this field. We have realized only 30% of the country's capacities in this industry.
The petrochemical industry is one of the essential pillars of development and the driving engine of various sectors of the country's economy these days. So far, this industry has reached several important goals, such as increasing export income, expanding downstream sectors, creating jobs, and increasing the GDP. These achievements have been emphasized in the general policies of the resistance economy, focusing on developing petroleum refineries to overcome the vulnerabilities of oil and gas markets. Recent studies indicate that the chain of petrochemical products, with the approach of creating petrochemical refineries, has relatively high advantages compared to chains with the traditional method. Iran will increase its production capacity for petrochemical products by more than a half in the next 3 years as the country moves ahead with plans to increase added value in its petroleum sector, according to government officials.
In the past, our government officials would say we should not sell crude oil. We should go towards petrochemical products. They tried to create petrochemicals, and today we are successful in this field. With the passage of time and the progress of the country, today the officials have taken a step forward in their minds, and the parliament divides petrochemical products into crude and semi-crude and levies duties for their export.
Meanwhile, petrochemical revenues from the export of 22 million tons of products have reached $15 billion in value during the first 11 months of the current Iranian year, that is from March 21, 2022 till February 19, 2023, based on reports by the National Petrochemical Company. Revenues of the petrochemical industry are projected to have increased by $4 billion compared to last Iranian year and reach $19 billion by March 2023.
My argument is that today, as the country is in urgent need for development and growth, we should move away from crude oil burning and go towards downstream petrochemical industries. Our oil companies should serve the country's Ministry of Industries in order to assist the manufacturing sector.
Also, reports show that last year petrochemical feedstock increased by 5 million tons, which were added to the production capacity of the industry. The annual output is now around 35 million tons and will approach 40 million tons by the end of 2023. Moreover, the Iranian government has indicated that stabilizing the price of petrochemical feed and reducing it by 40% can be an important step in reducing the cost of petrochemical products. With these measures, the government is trying to minimize the obstacles so that the advantage in this industry, in addition to the prosperity of the capital market, has an effective help in reducing currency fluctuations in the country.
The first change should be in the manager's approach. The approach of our elites must change. Sometimes our elites have the wrong idea. For example, they say that selling raw materials is bad, but then they go towards the establishment of a refinery. But this is wrong. Our resources are limited now. We must go towards completing the production cycle. That is, we must deliver the product to the Ministry of Industries and create employment.
Furthermore, a separate report by local media said that Iran will launch a total of 35 new petrochemical plants by 2025 to increase the output capacity in the sector by 54% to 140 million metric tons per annum. It said petrochemical output capacity in Iran had increased by 7% in the calendar year to March 2022 to reach nearly 91 million MTPA, thanks to the completion of 7 new petrochemical projects across the country.
This is Iran Today. Iran Today is broadcast every week on Fridays and Saturdays. The series analyzes major political, economic, cultural, and social events concerning Iran. So don't miss the opportunity to listen to Iran Today on IRIB English Radio.
There's plenty more right after a quick diversion into world media. Welcome to the news section of the program. I have picked excerpts from three news websites, starting with Financial Tribune. Jam Petrochem Company sets PE output record. The polyethylene unit of Jam Petrochemical Company in the port city of Asaluye, Bushehr province, has set a record in producing PE in the last Iranian year ended March 20, 2023, the head of the unit said. The unit produced more than 387,000 tons of PE last year, which was 87,000 tons more than the capacity initially designed for the plant. Ali Salimzadeh was also quoted as saying by INA. The unit is one of the largest polymer units in Iran, which produces different ranges of linear light and heavy polyethylene. The unit has the ability to produce more than 60 different grades with various applications, he added. Mehnu says, Iran-Venezuela ink MOUs on oil, gas, petrochemical. Iran and Venezuela signed memorandums of understanding on the development of oil and gas fields, reconstruction of refineries and petrochemical complexes, and oil trade. The documents and MOUs were signed in the presence of Iran's oil minister, Javad Oji, and Venezuelan's vice president, Delcy Rodriguez, and oil minister, Pedro Rafael Telichi, in Caracas. The development of oil and gas fields and the reconstruction and renovation of Venezuelan oil refineries with the aim of maximizing the capacity of these complexes are among the issues mentioned in the memorandums signed between Iran and Venezuela. Heading a delegation, the Iranian minister was officially welcomed by Venezuelan officials on Thursday. His visit is aimed at promoting Tehran-Caracas cooperation in the downstream and upstream sectors. According to Middle East Business and Financial News, Iran's oil production and exports continue to rise despite sanctions. Despite the negative impacts of U.S. sanctions, Iran has been ramping up its oil production and exports over the past few months. In the last 10 months of the past Iranian year, that is March 21, 2022, till January 20, 2023, the country's income from the sales of oil, natural gas, gas condensate, and petroleum products increased by 40% compared to the same period in the previous year. Addressing an open session of the parliament on February 1st, Iranian oil minister Javad Oji reported that 70 million barrels of gas condensate were exported during that time span. In November 2022, Iranian President Ebrahim Raisi stated that the country's oil export had reached pre-sanction levels, highlighting the failure of the enemy's policy of maximum pressure. Despite sanctions, Iran's oil production and exports continue to rise, with the U.S. Energy Information Administration reporting in January that Iran's average oil production in 2022 was 2.54 million barrels per day, 140,000 BPD more than the previous year. With continued growth in its oil industry, Iran is positioning itself to become a major player in the global market. During the last two decades, Iran has developed a significant petrochemical sector. Whenever it makes headlines, however, the reason is often international politics. In June 2019, for instance, the Trump administration imposed severe sanctions on the Persian Gulf Petrochemical Industries Company due to its alleged ties with the Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps. In reality, the reason had more to do with the significance of PGPIC for Iran's economy, which the U.S. has tried to choke through economic sanctions. The PGPIC group holds close to 40% of Iran's total petrochemical production capacity, and it's responsible for 50% of the country's petrochemical exports.
By nature, the countries on the Middle East side were the countries that mostly provided energy for the West and the East of the world. For example, Saudi Arabia or Iran. Their job was to produce crude oil and export it to Western countries. In this game of the world economy, countries of the Middle East were actually the losers.
We have had a very impressive growth in the field of upstream oil and gas industry. Today, we have the potential to produce nearly 4 million barrels of crude oil in the country, of course, if the pressure of these sanctions is reduced or lifted. In the field of gas, we have practically developed most of our fields.
The second reason why Iran's petrochemical industry gets coverage in the media has to do with sustainable development. According to the International Energy Agency, petrochemical products provide substantial benefits to society, including a growing number of applications in various cutting-edge clean technologies critical to sustainable energy systems. However, the production, use, and disposal of petrochemical-derived products present a variety of climate, air quality, and water pollution challenges that need to be addressed.
In Iran, the environmental organization is active in this field as the vice president and always checks petrochemical factories. Most of Iran's petrochemical industries tries to respect the environmental issues and never neglects it. We have tried to bring our petrochemical units to the coast where possible and to use seawater more than fresh drinking water. We also have a document called Land Acquisition, which emphasizes that petrochemical units should be close to oil sources, that is, by the sea. In this way, exports also will be easy.
To address these challenges, the IEA has outlined a clean technology scenario in a report which provides an alternative future in line with key UN Sustainable Development Goals, such as climate action, responsible consumption, and life below water, among others. The scenario provides an ambitious but achievable pathway to reduce the environmental impacts of petrochemicals, including air pollutants from primary chemicals production declined by almost 90% by 2015, direct carbon dioxide emissions reduced by nearly 60%, and water demand is nearly 30% lower than in the base scenario. It also emphasizes waste management improvements to rapidly increase recycling, thereby laying the groundwork to more than half cumulative ocean-bound plastic waste by 2050. Looking from the environmental perspective, does this industry cause any problems or threats to the environment? And how has environmental considerations been observed so far?
In the past 100 years, the developed countries have developed through cheap energy, crude oil and gas from third world countries or with coal. It means that they have polluted the environment for more than 100 years and that they have developed with cheap energy. Now that our turn has come, they are pressuring us that you must stop your growth because of the environment. European countries should be told that you must first compensate for the past 100 years that you have polluted the environment and then go to blame other countries. Iran, which is just on the path of development, should not be compared with America, and its growth and development were stopped with these excuses. America's refinery capacity is 19 to 20 million barrels per day. For decades, it has been burning more than 15 million barrels of crude oil on a daily basis.
The IEA's Future of Petrochemicals report was developed with input from governments, industry, and other key stakeholders and seeks to bring the sector the attention it deserves in the global energy policy debate. Accordingly, sanctions are set to be political tools aimed at isolating and hurting the target country's economy, forcing it to change policy. But in the short run, the target country may be forced to adopt alternative survivalist means to evade the grip of inhumane sanctions. In the case of Iran, sanctions have created a thirst for accelerated development to expand water resource infrastructure, generate power, and secure food and energy for Iranians. With aggressive homegrown policies, Iran has managed to evade the sanctions to the extent possible, while inadvertently overlooking environmental consequences. While imposed sanctions are not the main cause of Iran's environmental problems, they have exacerbated the situation and will affect the quality of life and health of many future generations of Iranians. This, then, is the chief dilemma the industry faces. It must continue to meet rising demand under sanctions while finding ways to mitigate its environmental impact and develop new strategies in terms of sustainable developments. But what measures does the industry currently take to neutralize sanctions and protect the environment?
We have a strategy called bypassing sanctions, and we also have another strategy which is neutralizing sanctions. Petrochemical industries and business managers are the main players in the sector of circumventing sanctions. But in the discussion of neutralizing the sanctions, as the analysis of this field have also acknowledged, we should slowly move towards the production of finished products and their exports.
Iran's first strategy is to reduce the vulnerability of its exports to U.S. sanctions by moving away from crude oil and condensate sales, further driving Tehran's shift to petrochemicals. The realization is that it will be easier to export compared to crude and condensate to global markets.
When you sell crude oil, only 200 to 300 refineries in the world can buy your product. But if you sell a polymer product, for example, small factories in some countries of the world, in some corner, can be buyers of your product. In fact, it can be said that petrochemical products have more demand, more customers, and therefore their susceptibility to sanctions is much less.
China has been the top customer of Iranian petrochemical shipments in recent years, while exports to countries in the region such as Iraq, India, and Turkey have also surged in recent years. Iran has a diversified petroleum product basket with more than 70 products. As a key player in supplying global petchem demands, Iran's main exports include polyethylene, methanol, benzene, ammonia, sulfur, PVC, and propylene. Tehran's second strategy is increased R&D in sustainable chemical production. In light of that, the petrochemical sector has planned to take optimal advantage of domestic companies in the hope of indigenizing all petrochemical products and equipment within the next few years. Based on the country's current five-year national development plan that is from 2022 till 2026, $35 billion of investment is going to be made in the country's petrochemical industry.
Petrochemical industry is faced with problems that can be solved easily by using the capacity of scientific and research centers. Many agreements have been signed between universities and petrochemical companies, such as Amir Kabir University and Zagros Petrochemical Company. Recently, a joint agreement was signed in the field of digital transformation in Jam Petrochemical between Presidential Deputy for Science, Jam Petrochemical Company, Sharif University of Technology, and Tao Innovation Ecosystem, in line with joint cooperation and capacity utilization of knowledge-based companies.
With abundant hydrocarbon reserves and private sector investments, Iran is working hard to broaden the scope of its petrochemical industry while indigenizing the equipment and machinery needed in the industry, which would be a huge step toward a brighter future for the country.
Iran's petrochemical market is very attractive for several reasons. The first point is that the petrochemical industry in Iran, given the fact that Iran has been under sanctions for many years, has a considerable amount of crude oil and natural gas that can be converted into petrochemical products. It means that raw material is available in abundance and reasonable price. The second advantage is Iran's domestic market. Iran's domestic market has the ability to absorb products produced in the petrochemical industry. It means that the market is attractive. Another issue is that in Iran, investors have easy access to cheap energy in various ways. Cost of labor, fuel, etc., all are cheap and available. These are very attractive and valuable to investors. In addition to these, investing in the Iranian market is reliable and safe.
Accordingly, the Petrochemical Industry Self-Sufficiency Center was launched with the aim of benefiting from knowledge-based and technology companies, domestic manufacturers, and universities and research centers. In line with the achievements attained by these efforts, the National Petrochemical Company has also stated that Iran is now ready to export technical and engineering services in the petrochemical industry to other countries. That's all for today. Thank you from the whole team. Do tune in same time next week and each week after. Don't forget to leave your comments and topic requests. Till next time, take care.
In the limelight.
Protests erupted after white man shoots black 16-year-old high school junior in the U.S. state of Missouri for ringing doorbell. The white American homeowner who shot black 16-year-old Ralph Yarl was released by the U.S. police 24 hours after being detained. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites and news agencies for further details. Stay tuned for more. Truth Out wrote in this regard, protests erupted recently in a Kansas City, Missouri neighborhood after a white homeowner shot a black teen twice. After the teen mistakenly rang the man's doorbell while trying to pick up his younger brothers. Ralph Jarl, a 16-year-old high school junior, was attempting to pick up his brothers from a house on 115th Terrace in the city. When he rang the doorbell of a house on 115th Street by mistake, a white man answered the door and shot Jarl in the head. As Jarl laid on the ground after being shot, the man, who has not been named by police, shot him for a second time in the arm. Though Jarl managed to escape, he went to three different houses in the neighborhood before someone helped him. Jarl was released from the hospital recently and is currently at home, continuing his recovery process. The homeowner was detained by police but released 24 hours later. Police have claimed they need more information before they can make an arrest. The man who shot Jarl will likely defend himself using Stand Your Ground laws, which allow people to use lethal force if they claim they were defending themselves or their property, even in circumstances where they could have avoided violence by stepping away from a confrontation. Such laws essentially allow white people to murder black and brown people with impunity, and evidence suggests black and brown people are rarely successful in citing such laws to defend themselves in the court. If arrested and charged, the white male shooter will almost certainly deploy Missouri's Stand Your Ground law to claim white owners have a right to murder black children who mistakenly ring their doorbells, black historian Abram X. Kendi wrote on Twitter, adding, "Because racist violence is usually projected as self-defense." Recently, around 1,000 people gathered to protest on the street where the shooting took place. Many chanted phrases in support of Jarl, including "Stand up, fight back, and justice for Ralph." Jarl's aunt, Dr. Faith Spoonmore, was among those who attended. She said, "Ralph will feel the love because this is a lot of people. It's amazing." Ralph's father, Paul Jarl, demanded that the legal system hold the man who shot his son accountable. "We just want justice. Ralph is a good kid. He doesn't deserve what is happening to him," Paul Jarl said, adding, "Our message for the prosecutor. We want charges. That's what we want. If he goes free, the next black kid that rings that doorbell could get shot again. We don't want that." Kansas City Council member Melissa Robinson also condemned the shooting. She said, "No justice, no peace. Now is the time for us to demonstrate that law and order applies to us all. We don't feel safe walking to the gas station or ringing a doorbell. It is situations like this that feed the ongoing distrust in law enforcement when black people are the victims of excessive or deadly force at the hands of white citizens and law enforcement," said Gwen Grant, president of the Urban League of Kansas City. Civil rights attorneys Ben Crump and Lee Merritt are representing the Jarl family. Both expressed outrage that police has so far refused to arrest the man who shot Jarl. Crump said, "You can't just shoot people without having justification when somebody comes knocking on your door. And knocking on your door is not justification. This guy should be charged. Ralph is fighting for his life. This man must be arrested," Merritt said in a tweet. The lawyers wrote in a joint statement that there is no excuse for the release of this armed and dangerous suspect, especially after the man admitted to shooting an unarmed, non-threatening, and defenseless teenager that rang his doorbell. According to Al Jazeera, former United States Representative Gabrielle Giffords, now a gun reform advocate, also expressed her frustration on social media. As someone who is still recovering from a gunshot to the head, I am heartbroken and infuriated that Ralph Jarl now faces a lifetime of recovery at 16 years old for simply ringing a doorbell, she wrote, adding, we cannot continue to be a nation defined by gun violence and injustice. Some of the criticism was directed at local prosecutors and law enforcement who had previously taken Lester into custody before releasing him pending further investigation. Critics questioned why it had taken days to file charges and make a formal arrest. There were things that had to be done in order to build the case on a solid foundation, Prosecutor Thompson told the press recently. That means attempting to get a formal statement from the witness in the case. That means waiting for forensic lab results to be processed. Merritt, one of the lawyers representing Jarl, dismissed that rationale in a statement, saying, I can say with absolute certainty that the excuses being offered are not true.
Congratulations to all world Muslims with the arrival of the blessed Eid al-Fitr, marking the end of the holy fasting month of Ramadan. Congratulations to all our Muslim listeners.
Savior.
Oh, the Savior of mankind, please show us a sign.
To the designer of the human civilization that is established on the unity of Almighty Allah.
Light of Allah, you are a true guide.
To the redeemer of human volition and thought.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. A very warm welcome. You're listening to the program, The Last Savior. and I'm your host, Zainab. Prophet Muhammad, may peace be upon him and his purified family, said, "The one who does not know the Imam of his time dies the death of an ignorant." But in this program, we try to give all the important details one needs to know about the Imam of his time. And today we have had the pleasure to invite Dr. Kareem in our episode. Assalamu alaikum.
Wa alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah.
A very warm welcome.
Thank you for having me.
It's a pleasure to have you, sir. So, all right, Dr. Karimi, when we say that Khasfil Baida is one of the definite signs of reappearance of Imam, which means there will be a land named Baida in between Makkah and Medina, which is going to swallow up army of Sufyani. Now, I want to ask you in this episode, what is this army up to? Why we have this, that this army is going to be swallowed up miraculously by this land? What is the target? What is the goal and aim of this army?
When it comes to Khasf Baida, as you rightly mentioned, an army of Sufyani, not the whole army of Sufyani. Sufyani has different armies. One of them is going to be swallowed up by the land in Baida, and of course the other army will be they will fight Imam Mahdi alayhi salam. Now the question is that, as you rightly mentioned, what is the goal and aim of this army? Now we said that this army will be swallowed up in Baida between Mecca and Medina. Now the first question is that this army is heading toward Mecca or it is heading toward Medina.
Yeah.
We have two groups of the narrations in this regard. According to some narrations, the army is going toward the city of Mecca. In one narration, Imam al-Baqir alayhi salam, in an authentic narration, he is quoted as saying that فَيَبْلُغُ أَمِيرَ جَيْشِ السُّفْيَانِ أَنَّ الْمَهْدِي قَدْ خَرَجَ إِلَى مَكَّةِ. The commander of the army of Sufyani is informed that Imam Mahdi alayhi salam has gone toward the city of Mecca. فَيَبْعَثُ جَيْشًا عَلَىٰ أَثَرِهِ. So he sends an army to capture Imam Mahdi alayhi salam. فَلَا يُدْرِكُهُ حَتَّى يَدْخُلَ مَكَّةِ. They are not able to find the Imam until the Imam reaches the city of Mecca. And then the Imam says that they will be swallowed up by the land in the place which is called Al-Baida. This is in Al-Ghiba by Nu'mani, page 288, hadith number 67. In another narration, Imam Ali alayhi salam is quoted as saying, ثُمَّ يَسِيرُ ذَلِكَ الْجَيْشِ إِلَى مَكَّةِ. Then that army will go toward the city of Mecca. وَإِنِّي لَأَعْلَمُ إِسْمَ أَمِيرِهِمْ وَعِدَّتِهِمْ وَأَسْمَائِهِمْ وَسَمَاتِ خُجُولِهِمْ. I, meaning Imam Ali alayhi salam, I know the name of their commander, the number of the army, their names, even the signs on their horses. And then they are heading toward the city of Mecca, but then when they reach Baida, then they will be swallowed up. This narration is quoted in the famous book of Sulaym ibn Qais, page 309. In another narration, which is quoted in Mukhtasar Basair al-Darajat, page 199, we are told that an army will go to capture a man from the progeny of the Prophet, referring to Imam Mahdi alayhi salam, who is in the city of Mecca with his, supporters. And before reaching Mecca, they will be swallowed up in Baida, and only one of them will survive. So these three narrations are referring to the fact that this army is going from a place toward the city of Mecca. But then we have another group of narrations according to which they are going to the city of Medina.
All right, so there's also a conflict between, is this army heading towards Mecca or towards Medina? Now you gave us some of the narrations which say that they're heading towards Mecca, and now we have some narrations which talk about that army is heading towards Medina. We'll talk about them after a short break. Dear listeners, stay tuned. Welcome back. You're listening to The Last Savior. We have Dr. Karimi with us in the studio today. And Dr. Karimi, you have been talking about the army that is heading either towards Mecca or towards Medina, but with the intention, what intention they carry what we have learned so far is that the target is Imam, but where they're heading and what is their ultimate goal, you're helping us with that. You talked about the narrations which say that the army is heading towards Mecca, and now you said there are also some narrations which say that the army is heading towards Medina.
So the second group also has some narrations in favor of it. For example, in one narration, Imam Sadiq alayhi salam is quoted as saying that Sufyani will send an army toward the city of Medina, and then the people who are from the progeny of Imam Ali alayhi salam, and they are in the city of Medina, they will go to the city of Mecca and will join Imam Mahdi alayhi salam.
All right.
This is in Al-Kafi, volume 8, page 224. And another narration from Imam Ali alayhi salam, which says that Sufyani will have a kind of uprising in Sham, and the people of Sham will follow him, will support him. He will come to Medina with a very big army, and then when they reach Baida, then they will be swallowed up. Now, it seems that there is a kind of contradiction between these two groups of the narrations, but there is a solution mentioned by the scholars, and that is the fact that when we pay attention to other narrations talking about Sufyani, we see that there is a course of events taking place here. First of all, the army of Sufyani goes to the city of Medina searching for the Imam, and then they will kill many people in Medina. They will plunder the city for some days, according to some narrations. Then Imam, who by that time is in the city of Medina, he will go to Mecca, and the army is heard about that, the commander of the army. So they follow the Imam who has gone to the city of Mecca. And then when they reach the place called Baida between Medina and Mecca, they will be swallowed up. So there is no contradiction between these two groups of the narrations. The army of Sufyani, first of all, goes to Medina seeking for the Imam. They do not find the Imam, but they kill many people. They plunder the city. Then they will go toward the city of Mecca to kill the Imam, but on the way, they will be swallowed up in the place called Baida.
All right.
Now, having said that, I think now the point is clear. What is the aim of this army? And some narrations, they say that they are looking for a person in Mecca to kill him. But the other narrations, they specifically mention that they are searching for Imam Mahdi alayhi salam to kill. And as I mentioned in one of the previous sessions, the main goal of Sufyani and his army is just to kill the Shia.
Okay.
So there are some narrations in this regard. For example, Imam Ali alayhi salam is quoted as saying, this is in one of the Sunni sources, the army of Sufyani, they go toward the city of Mecca to kill the people, to find the people that they are searching for.
Okay.
This narration does not mention the names. But then they will reach Baida, and then the earth will swallow up the army. This is in Al-Fitan, page 203. In one narration from Imam al-Baqir alayhi salam, it is quoted that إِذَا سَمِعَ الْعَائِذُ الَّذِي بِمَكَّةَ بِالْخَاسِفِ خَرَجَ مَعَ 12,000 فِيهِمُ الْأَبْدَالِ. The one who has gone to the city of Mecca somehow to be safe from this army of Sufyani, when they hear the news of Khasf, then he will begin his uprising together with 12,000 people. And then they will go to Baitul Maqdis, and there would be a fight.
All right.
And this narration also does not mention the name of Imam Mahdi alayhi salam, but the other narrations that I will share later in today's session, they mention the name of the Imam.
Sure, we'll discuss the narrations after a short break. Dear listeners, stay tuned with us.
I can feel your eyes, like the sun shining behind the clouds. I need a morning to shatter this long night forever. I need a hero to stop this thousand-year-old morning.
Welcome back. You're listening to the IRIB English Radio. This is The Last Savior. We have Dr. Karimi with us in the studio. Dr. Karimi has been helping us to understand the event of Baida. Where is the army heading towards? What is the ultimate target? And Dr. Karimi.
As I mentioned, what is the aim of the army of Sufyani? They are looking for Imam Mahdi alayhi salam to kill. Some narrations mention that the army of Sufyani is looking for some people in Mecca to kill. In the second narration from Imam al-Baqir alayhi salam, the Imam is talking about al-A'idh al-Ladhi bi Mecca, the one who has taken refuge in the city of Mecca. The Imam does not mention the name. But then we have one authentic narration from Imam al-Baqir alayhi salam, who is quoted as saying, وَيَبْحَثُ السُّفْيَانِ بَحْثًا إِلَى الْمَدِينَةِ. Sufyani sends an army toward the city of Medina. فَيَنْفَرُ الْمَهْدِ مِنْهَا إِلَى مَكَّةِ. Imam Mahdi alayhi salam is in the city of Medina. He comes to know about this army, so he goes to Mecca to be safe from the army of Sufyani. فَيَبْلُغُ أَمِيرَ جَيْشِ السُّفْيَانِ أَنَّ الْمَهْدِ قَدْ خَرَجَ إِلَى مَكَّةِ. Then the commander of the Sufyani's army is informed that Mahdi has gone to the city of Mecca, so they will follow the Imam to search him. But before they and the Imam reaches the city of Mecca, but before that, they will be swallowed up in the land called Baida.
All right.
So the conclusion of all these narrations is that the main goal of the Sufyani and his great army is to kill the Shia. He sends one of his armies, especially to Jaziratul Arab, to kill Imam Mahdi alayhi salam. First of all, they come to know that Imam Mahdi alayhi salam is in the city of Medina, so they send
head
the army towards
Medina.
The Imam comes to know about that, so somehow he
changes the location,
or he seeks for a safe place. That is why he goes toward the city of Mecca, but the army of Sufyani kill many people in Medina. When they are told that the Imam has gone toward the city of Mecca, they also
try to capture
the Imam in Mecca. But on the way, they will be swallowed up in a very miraculous way in the land called Baida. And inshallah, we'll talk about how miraculous and why this miraculous event should take place in the land called Baida in the following session, inshallah.
Inshallah. So far, we have reached the conclusion that one of the definite signs of reappearance is the event of Ghazwat al-Baida, where Baida is the name of a land between Mecca and Medina, wherein swallowing up of land is going to take place, and the land is going to swallow up the army of Sufyani, whose target is to kill Shias, and in order to fulfill their goals, they first head towards Medina and then kill some of the people over there. But when they ultimately get to know that Imam has left the place and has actually is now heading towards Mecca, they start going towards Mecca after Imam. But in between the way, the land, which is called as Baida, they get swallowed up by that land. And we'll get to know more about this event of Ghazwat al-Baida in the upcoming episodes from Dr. Karimi. Thank you so much, Doctor, for being with us. Thank you so much to our listeners. In case you want to listen to our programs again, please go to our official website, which is www.parstoday.ir/en. You can go to the tab COI, Call of Islam, and search all our programs there. You can search our previous programs because we have had some messages. Where can we find your previous episodes? You can find our previous episodes on the same site. And you can also send us your feedback, send us your queries regarding the Imam on our email, which is englishradio@irib.ir. Until another session, wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Where is the rising sun?
in the limelight.
The British Bureau of Statistics announced a significant increase in the unemployment rate, which shows the first effects of the economic recession following the energy crisis and the sharp increase in the cost of living in Britain. Unemployment in the United Kingdom has risen dramatically, and the government is now looking for new sources of income and spending that can curb this trend. We take a look at some of the world media and press's coverage of this issue. Please stay with us. Website of Sky News has covered this story and tells us more. The official figures showed the UK unemployment rate has edged up unexpectedly, highlighting a faster-than-expected spike in wage rises in the face of skyrocketing inflation across the country. According to the figures presented by the Office for National Statistics, ONS, on Tuesday, Britain's job vacancies have fallen for the ninth straight month, in a sign that the uncertain economic outlook is heavily impacting the British job market. The data revealed that the unemployment rate also rose to 3.8% in the 3 months to February, the highest level since the second quarter of 2022, while vacancies fell by another 47,000 in the first 3 months of 2023. The increase in the unemployment rate appeared as a surprise for the government, as most economists had expected the rate to remain unchanged. The Office for National Statistics, ONS, said firms continue to cite economic pressure as a factor in holding back on recruitment, as they can't afford employees' wages. Meanwhile, total pay, including bonuses, grew at an annual rate of 5.9% in the 3 months to February. According to the Office for National Statistics, ONS, regular pay, excluding bonuses, also continued to rise by 6.6%, but down by 3.4% with Consumer Prices Index inflation taken into account. The Bank of England's Monetary Policy Committee is watching wage growth carefully for signs that inflation is remaining stubborn and may consider raising interest rates once again in May in the light of recent figures. Martin Beck, the chief economist advisor at EY Item Club, said, given the Bank of England's Monetary Policy Committee's wariness around inflation's persistence, February's strong rise in private sector regular pay could easily shift the majority in a more hawkish direction. Ellie Henderson at Investec Economics added, we think that on balance, the Monetary Policy Committee of the Bank of England will raise the bank rate by 25 basis points to 4.5%, but that will be the last hike in this tightening cycle. Eddie Henderson added, today's data release arguably supports that call. The labour market is still tight, suggesting a further tightening of the screws. The economic pressure and the cost of living crisis have prompted many workers across different industries to hold industrial action now and then, causing disruption in services in different sectors such as Royal Mail, British Rail, National Health Service, the NHS. Junior doctors are the latest group to strike, seeking a 35% pay rise to compensate for below-inflation pay rises over more than a decade. According to the Office for National Statistics, ONS, discontent over pay in the public sector saw 348,000 working days lost to strikes in February, up from 210,000 in January. It has been worried that pay growth to match inflation only raises the already surging prices. A cost-of-living crisis driven by sharp food and energy price increases has left the British people struggling to pay their bills. The Conservative government argues that pay increases would increase inflation, which currently stands at 10.4%. The British newspaper The Daily Mail has also covered this story and tells us more. The fallout from the wave of strikes was underlined on Tuesday, 18th of April, with figures showing nearly 350,000 working days were lost in February. The number of days lost due to industrial action was up to 348,000 from 210,000 the previous months, with almost three-fifths down to the education sector. The number of stoppages hit 654, the highest ever recorded by the Office for National Statistics, with 250,000 workers involved. Just under 1.4 million days have been eradicated since December, a month when the level reached 826,000. Strikes have been taking place across the National Health Service, Education, the Civil Service, and Rail, as workers demanded higher pay amid the cost of living crisis. The Office for National Statistics data show that the highest number of stoppages in a previous month was 530 back in 1970. The figure appears to have been pushed up because school strikes are counted as separate disputes between staff and their direct employer, which can be academies or the local authority. The stark numbers were revealed in statistics showing the jobs market defying the economic slowdown, but real-term wages are still tumbling and long-term sickness has hit a new record. Britain's Chancellor of the Exchequer, Jeremy Hunt, claimed unemployment is still close to historic lows, despite official figures showing the rate nudging up from 3.7% to 3.8% in the 3 months to February. Pay continues to be outstripped by surging inflation, with total wages, including bonuses, up 5.9%, but down by 4.1% when headline Consumer Prices Index CPI is taken into account. Worryingly for the Bank of England, which is trying to keep a lid on prices, regular private sector wages were increasing faster than expected at 6.9%. British newspaper The Guardian has also covered this story and tells us more. The real value of UK workers' pay continued to fall at the fastest rate for more than a decade, as wage increases in February were outstripped by high inflation. The Office for National Statistics, ONS, said annual growth in average pay, excluding bonuses, held steady at 6.6% in the 3 months to February, despite a small rise in unemployment and decline in the number of job vacancies. Fueled by bumper pay for bankers and accountants in the City of London, wage growth, including bonuses, rose by 5.9%. Economists had forecast weaker rates of pay growth in a potential dilemma for the Bank of England as it considers whether to raise interest rates for a 12th consecutive time in May. However, the Office for National Statistics said total pay fell by 4.1% on the year after taking inflation into account, among the largest falls since 2009. Reflecting softer conditions in the jobs market as Britain's economy struggles for growth momentum, the unemployment rate unexpectedly rose to 3.8%. The number of job vacancies also fell for the ninth consecutive month, although remained high at more than 1.1 million as companies struggle to recruit staff. The Chancellor of the Exchequer, Jeremy Hunt, said, "While unemployment remains close to historic lows, rising prices continue to eat into paychecks, which is why halving the inflation rate this year is one of our top economic priorities. Average wage growth in the public sector picked up to 5.3% on the year, the fastest annual rate since 2005, although continued to lag behind wage growth of 6.9% in the private sector." Paul Novak, the Trades Union Council General Secretary said the figures showed workers were suffering the longest wage slump in modern history. Calling on ministers to resolve pay disputes, Paul Novak said, hard-pressed families can't take money.